dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which really does want to know where Captain Jack was hiding his compact laser deluxe. I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
I'm James.
And I'm a pair of white Bakelite falsies and a barely concealed pistol for this one.
Well, we've arrived back on Satellite 5 only to find ourselves trapped in the kinds of TV shows that we think it's smart to utterly despise. Will we beat the odds, or will we succumb to the machinations of the Bad Wolf? So I'm going to lay my cards on the table. This is my favourite Doctor Who episode, or at least part one of my favourite Doctor Who story of all time.
That's a big call, Nathan.
It is a bit of a big call. I'm happy for any of you to fight me about it, if you like.
I would have said, if I hadn't watched it this weekend, that you were wrong. But then I fell in love with it. I hadn't watched it for about 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. And I remembered it as being, fun, sort of exciting, but a bit of a mess. And it's just, I think it's probably one of the best season finales of the new series.
I'd like to throw in, because I will be the Todd for a second before Todd gets to be Todd. I think it's good, but it's only good because of where it sits. So if you isolate it and watch it just as its own Doctor Who story, it's a picture postcard TV week, maybe Daily Mirror version of what Doctor Who is thought to be. And it does pull that off brilliantly. It really is a very successful. It's meticulous writing. It's how a normal person thinks a Doctor Who show should be written. So that doesn't necessarily allow it to ever be in my top favourite list, because, as you said, we like to think we're better than that. It is very well done, but I don't think it's not as powerful in isolation. It's only because of all the brilliant things, and the peaks and troughs of this season. It's like the hills and valleys of Wales itself, he said, not doing the accent. But, you've had the lumps of Rose and the lumps of Rose. I missed that one. And then the peaks of Aliens and World War III. And so, you've got those big moments, and then the little it's like a beautiful little symphonette. And then you've got little moments where you've got the diminuendo of Boomtown, which is a lovely little character piece and exactly what you needed to see everybody having a lovely time. And then Mickey get to say to them, "You're awful, all of you." And you know what happens when someone says that. So, yeah. It is beautifully done.
I think I've said before that the kind of basic narrative unit of the new series is the season, really, rather season than the story. And so I think that kind of reinforces what you say. This story is not really a story by itself so much as a culmination of things that have happened over the past, 11 episodes, and it draws from all sorts of previous things in the season and sort of brings them to a head. And it climaxes a lot of narrative threads that have been going all the way along. And so in context, I think it does work better than perhaps in isolation.
I would agree with that. Can I be me for a moment?
Yes.
Hi, listeners. How are you? This is a brand new episode for me.
Wait, what?
Because, obviously I've got no memory of this episode, because I sat down to watch it and I went, it's going to start in the Big Brother house. Well, no, we get a recap of the Long Game.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went, I don't remember that. And then as I was watching, whether it be Big Brother or The Weakest Link or What Not to Wear or the people controlling the games, I'm going, what is this dialogue? What are these camera angles? And I'm just there going, I have edited out of my memory so much of this episode. I actually sat there saying to myself, I must be insane. I cannot remember half the dialogue. I think I've watched too many YouTube clips of YouTube reactors looking at the highlights. And so I've got certain lines in my head, but other things I just had no memory of. Nathan, you know how when we watch the classic series, you virtually have the whole thing playing out in your head and you know all the beats. I just had absolutely no idea. I actually had to get up, go to the Blu-ray case, and I looked at it because I swear to God, I thought it was a special edition director's cut. I just could not believe it. I love it. I'm like you. This is my favorite episode of the season.
Yeah, I think it really is extraordinary. And part of it's down to Joe Ahern. So Joe Ahern is the director for kind of the last recording block because Christopher Eccleston allegedly refused to work with anyone else. But he is amazingly good. And the way this is directed and the lighting was one of the things that struck me is so strong. And there's some really, really, really terrific stylish direction in it.
Yes. It's about the direction. It's about using characters. He gets it. And there's also the lovely little everyman play he throws in. It's a morality tale. This could actually just be done with no set, like a proper Shaking Spear show. You don't need all the bangs and whistles. And that's why it's done this way, I feel, because it is about characters. I really didn't like it when it first came on because we were all hating Big Brother for the amorality of it at the time. Yeah. That was the discussion, is that this is allowing people to be base and venal in ways that we just didn't grow up with, and we were always taught not to support. You're really too pleased with yourself. We did think that. Don't be too pleased with yourself.
Yeah, no.
It was one of the tenets of childhood of the 70s.
That's probably why the juxtaposition of that with the morality of Doctor Who works.
And that's why it goes so beautifully, because the most chilling moment for me is when you realise they're all on Satellite 5 and there's just floors and floors of this Death Games 2000 going on.
Yeah.
And they all seem quite sort of okay with it.
That's the point.
Up until the point of the death point. Like, you know, in the Big Brother house, they're oh, yes, it's an eviction and all this sort of stuff and we're all together, but it's not until the moment you have to step into the corridor of death.
The killing booth.
Then it's suddenly like they're all sort of emotional.
And they're all enabling it, just like Russell's been telling us for years. It's a beautiful morality play.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's why the shonkiness of the sets. And you can say, okay, we have to save money for the finale because we're certainly not getting it on this set. All of the rest of it. But it works really well for that as well, because he always shows the banality is humanity, simplicity is humanity.
It's the modern world and its approach to television morality taken to the extreme.
Well, I mean, if you think about the game shows, I'm vastly older than nearly everyone who's listening to this. But the game shows of my youth were sort of rather genteel affairs and, you know, Blankety Blanks.
Blankety Blanks.
Which was plural in Australia, in fact, and was fabulously rude and sort of naughty, but just terribly funny and silly, and things like Sale of the Century and Family Feud. And what was the competitive... Richard, what was the show? Was it Pot of Gold or something?
I think
Bernard King would criticise your singing.
Bernard King's single entendre anal dilation show. I think that's really pretty much what they all were.
don't try and search for that on YouTube, though.
If they'd done this story in the 70s, what would the reference points have been?
Well, I mean, the thing is that you can only do it at this particular time, because there is anxiety about the kinds of moral behaviour that are rewarded in competitive reality shows.
Yeah.
And so those shows sort of seem dark. And the attitude of this episode to those shows is complicated.
Exactly.
So clearly we're celebrating all of those shows by recreating them and using all of their music, using all of the guest stars. We get Davina McColl, we get, you know, the android, we get Trini and Susanna. They're all in it, like the actual people. We've licensed the music, we've got the logo from Demerol or whatever. It's all there. And so it's an absolute loving homage to it. And even the Doctor, when he's talking about watching these TV shows, he loves Bear With Me, the one where the bear gets in the bath with them, you know. Like, he loves this stuff as well, and it's clear that Russell does too. But it's a system that is backed by capitalism, and we saw that the people running Satellite 5 in the long game were a consortium of bankers, and we saw that that was capitalism corrupting the media, and now we have capitalism corrupting game shows, and this is a huge system where people are just eaten up for the entertainment of other people. So it is really conflicted in its attitude. It loves these shows, but it kind of recognises that they're sort of awful.
A guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
For me, it's because these shows were still fairly new at the time. You know, Big Brother was only about 5 years old.
Right.
And even The Weakest Link was cooling at this point. But it's very different from now, like almost 12 years later, I think. there's a different attitude. There was still very new, all these reality shows and the commentary.
You think
it was very fresh. Now we're a lot more jaded and, oh, it's another one of these and this is how the people are going to react. And you look at the editing of them now and you can virtually call it out what it's going to be like, you know, before the commercial break. But yeah. It's just tickles my fancy, the whole, like, different lines, like Davina Droid going, we're going to get you. And, like, they're all into it and Android. I just think that is just brilliant. The Android is the Android.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of those names, like you mentioned the bear one, but I had to write them down because I just crack up, like, call my bluff with real guns. Countdown, 30 seconds to stop the bomb. Ground force, get turned into compost. Wipeout speaks for itself. Stars in their eyes, literally. Don't sing, get blinded. It's just wonderful.
And
what would they have done to Susan Coleman?
Yeah, no, this is pretty Strictly, sadly.
Mm. Let's talk about the game shows, and we'll start with Big Brother. So we've got Linda with a Y, who I adore, played by Joe Joyner, who went on very next year to be in EastEnders for quite some time. And I really like Linda with a Y. I actually thought she was like the alternative Rose.
Mm. I think there's an attempt to make her that. And certainly you get that shot when the doctor calls her out into the corridor where he's just failed to be kind of evicted from life. And we get her point of view shot with him holding out his hand.
Just as in Rose.
Yeah.
And then you get that lovely moment from The End of the World where she's standing in the glass, appears to be, but this time Eccles doesn't save her.
Oh, spoilers.
So there are lots of little mirrors to Rose and Rose's introductory first two episodes in this one.
We'll talk a little bit more about that next week when Rose and Linda meet up.
I conflate these episodes. Because to me it is one story.
Yeah. I do think, though, it does better than, say, Aliens of London in making the two episodes distinct. Aliens of London has that big, giant, terrible cliffhanger that we all hated and then just sort of resolves the cliffhanger and heads off. Whereas this one has, you know, we lead up to the discovery of the Daleks and there's no sort of sign that there are going to be Daleks in it.
There's no massive Dalek fart.
Right. Except for the next time trailer in Boomtown.
Well, that's right.
It is interesting how they actually get into the three different scenarios.
Yeah.
The fact that the TARDIS is invaded. And this seems to be the only time that it actually happens in the new series that I can think of, or the old series. Like, you know, the TARDIS is usually an impenetrable fortress that people can't get into. But
until my cat came along and did it in the pyramids of Sutekh, the destroyer. Yeah. Well, Sutekh managed to push his way in.
Did he?
Probably-ish.
He's projected his face. Was projected.
Yeah, but I mean, to actually extract them out of the TARDIS, which normally it's like Force Field City and you can't get in.
But we're post-Time War now, so the Daleks really do understand millennial-old TARDISes and how to defeat them.
I think that's pretty good. The Doctor also says that it's 15 million times stronger than any other transmat.
Yeah.
So
that was a new line for me this episode too.
But I think it just makes it very simple. It's, you know, it gets us there.
What do you think of the other characters in the Big Brother house?
So we've got Crosby and Strood, and Crosby is the one who is evicted from life. And Strood is the sort of rather pissy little gay boy who is very cross at the Doctor's arrival. Oh. And it strikes me that we haven't actually seen that at all in Doctor Who before. You know, there have been people who've been obviously fabulously gay, even in the classic series. But, you know, a young man who just sort of seems to be terribly camp and openly gay, that seems to be a sort of new one. And they're super obsessed with the rules. They all clearly watch Big Brother at home. You know, they all know about it.
But wouldn't you be freaking out? I'm in the Big Brother house. I am going to die unless I win.
But if that's the norm of your life, if, like, your whole existence is watching television, what is it, like that quote, eat, sleep, watch TV, go to bed?
Yeah.
Eat chips, go to bed, sorry. If your whole existence is about watching these television shows and that anyone can be in them and the way they end is with your death, like, if that's the norm of your life, why would you question it? It's been going on for, what, four generations by this point? Like 100 years?
Yeah.
but how can the Earth just doesn't evolve? People can't have jobs. Nothing will happen because, like, you know, you can't plan anything because you're going to die. Like, you could be extracted at any time.
I think the level of kind of realism that we should expect from this world that's built is sort of fairly low. Mm. when I first saw this when I was a kid, I was kind of going, how come in the year 200,000 they still know about what not to wear, the weakest link and Big Brother? And my assumption was that the villain, the guy who at the end of the next time trailer says, they survived through me. I thought that was Adam. For sure.
Really?
Did you?
Well, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Well, that was how we would have known about these game shows. Oh, but of course...
I just assumed it was Janet Fielding.
Obviously, it turns out the reason that we have these game shows in the year, you know, 200,000 is that it's on a TV show being screened in 2005. And I also think the reason that everyone isn't freaking out in the Big Brother house is because we need the big reveal that people are going to die. And the reveal that these game shows are all evil and murderous comes at roughly the same time in the episode for each one.
It definitely does. And it does it exactly the same way as Scandinavian crime and detective fiction, which wasn't a big genre on TV or in film the way that it is now. You know, the girl with the dragon boat bottom, that, you know, those shows. I think Eccles is actually in one of them, isn't he? But all of that stuff existed as Scandinavian detective fiction and was really big, but it did also exist on TV at this time. It had just been starting. So folk within TV, in the same way that, say, an extraordinary show like Pose at the moment, which is groundbreaking in the way The Wire was 5 or 6 years ago. Everyone within the medium is talking about it, but our lot are only talking about it this year. So Russell was already watching these things and seeing the next stage of dramatic television is game shows where you actually are deaded. Like an episode of The Goodies from 1972, they did this as well. Again, because it's our podcast, we have to talk about the ostensible threat. And in this case, it is TV itself,
yeah,
and how it maligns our humanity and diminishes us and makes us into a delicious sago pudding type affair.
Yes. Mm. So the Big Brother house has Struden Crosby.
Strudel Crosby.
Yes, yes.
Denise Strudel Crosby.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But Crosby is very quickly evicted from life, isn't she? And that's actually quite upsetting, I think.
Well, I've noticed there's a lot of people of colour that get murdered in these episodes. Have you noticed that?
People complain that Doctor Who doesn't show a lot of on-screen death, but it does here.
Oh, it does. It always has.
I think there is a problem with the people of colour. Look, we're recording this the week after the Series 11 opening, and everyone's obviously hugely upset.
That's exactly where I was going with about, that. Yeah. Yeah.
So we could have had a black, middle-aged female companion.
I'm right here.
And she dies. But I think there is a problem that if a show is going to have diverse casting, it's going to have diverse deaths.
Yes.
And I think people have gone through and done the maths on this. But it is, you know, it is a concern. It's something that people are aware of, I think. Shall we talk about the weakest link?
Yes, let's talk about the weakest link.
So, Todd, which vowel appears in the word dangle, but not in the word glad?
I don't know.
Dongle.
Was it you?
E? No.
Is it an E?
E. This is absolutely, for me, the most successful of the game shows. And the reason it's successful is that I think Billie Piper is absolutely phenomenal.
She nails it beautifully. So is Patterson Joseph.
Yeah. Oh, he's appalling. One of the worst actors ever perpetrated in the history of Doctor Who. At the time, there was all these rumours that he could possibly be the next Doctor. He should never
Bond.
He should never, ever be cast in a television show ever again.
I think he's really massively unlikable, and I think that that is a deliberate thing.
I think he's perfect. He really is all those things Todd's saying. He's vile. And he's note perfect at it. And he even does that awful shtick when he's about to be moided later on, spoiler alert. And he does that with... Oh, it's everything's over the top. He's perfect.
Yeah.
Really liked it.
I think he's a good foil for her, and I think that she absolutely sells this. And her trajectory is our trajectory. Initially, we think it's really funny that Rose has found herself on the weakest link, and she thinks it's really funny as well. And then as that first round plays out, everyone is getting more and more terrified. And there's Fitch, who loses the round and who is crying. And you get Rose, just like us, going, actually, like, what's the problem? It's just a game show. Why are you crying? And then, obviously, she's killed.
However, I think it probably dawns on us before it dawns on Rose, which is very clever writing. Billy Piper is sensational. I think the character played by Patterson Joseph is really well written and is absolutely perfect, and he is unlikable. I just, you know, some actors you just dislike. I just dislike him. That's all I can say.
He has that in a lot of the roles he plays, though. Well, I think that's, he's got that air about him. That's probably why they cast him.
Yeah. Probably. But it is brilliant in the way the terror and the panic of these people is coming through. And it's much more immediate because you only have a round and you're dead. In Big Brother, you have a week in the house or 3 weeks. Yeah. Like, it's only in that last moment. So, yes.
I think when Linda with a Y and Jack and the doctor go to rescue Rose, Linda gives us the impression that the weakest link is the most terrifying of the game shows. And partly it's because of the android, but I think probably it is just the rate at which people get killed as well. I really love the questions. I think the questions are just so fantastically brilliant. And that final round, the way it works is that there's that brilliant, brilliant question, and it's part of the world building, which we'll talk about a little bit later, but which Icelandic city hosted Murder Spree 20? And obviously most of us at home can only name Reykjavik. And this is the question that if she loses, it's clear from the Chiron on the screen that if she loses the round. And she says Reykjavik. And you think, well, yes, no, she's been able to think of Reykjavik, she'll be fine. And, of course, it isn't that at all. But all that other world-building stuff, like she knows who the oldest inhabitant of the Isolde galaxy is.
Yeah. That's really good, you know, harking back to the face of Bo. And then there's a question in there about Torchwood shadowing events that is to come. But, no, the questions are delicious.
Yeah, it's that Russell thing of, you know, making the future sort of silly and funny. But it's super dark. Like, all of the questions build up this picture of a world that is really kind of horrible, I think.
This story is also quite rich in references to the show's past.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, like, it's not just the references to the web planet. It's also the references to the lunar penal colony.
Yeah, yeah.
From Frontier in Space. Mm. The fact that the controller betrays the Daleks and is then killed.
Day of the Daleks.
Day of the Daleks.
Also, the idea that you wire a girl into your computers. If you're the Daleks, you wire someone up from a very young age. She was five.
She is Jasmine Brakes.
She is Jasmine Brakes.
Wow, there's a lot of little subtle references here. Very clever, Russell. What not to wear?
What not to wear?
With Trini and Susanna.
This is my favourite bit. I like this one. I just really thought the robots were gorgeous.
Those robots are great, and having them do the voices and even reference their own advice, like, which never wear black with colour.
My mother has been saying that for years and years.
And you referenced earlier, I think, Richard, to the fact that
bum jokes.
Well, Jack strokes the breasts of one of them.
He does.
Yes, he really does.
It was another moment that I could not remember, which was new for me.
I was looking at it and going, surely that would be cut.
Robo breasts. There's probably no rule.
Unlike Jack's butt, which was the only cut the BBC asked for in series one, was like,
you can't
originally
show his bum.
Originally, that
so
shot.
I thought his bum was in it.
In the original filming, they had shot it full length. You could see his bottom, and they edited it so that it cuts at just the right moment that you don't.
James, in my extended cut that I watched, I think I saw it.
That was in your imagination, Todd.
I swear it was there.
I watched it last night. It wasn't. Now with added butt shots.
the defabricator. What a wonderful device that was. Like, it's so fun. Like, we're laughing about it now. Yeah. It's just such a great play on defibrillator But yeah, in the context, it's just so appropriate for them and Jack and... I'm just smiling now, listeners.
Yeah, yeah, it's really sort of terribly great. And it plays to Barrowman's strengths. You know, he's so ludicrously confident. There used to be this sort of story that he would get naked in radio interviews, like in the studio, or he would at least sort of talk about stripping off in sort of BBC Radio 4 interviews and stuff like that. He's just sort of super confident. And the fact that he's completely unfazed about just sort of having his clothes dissolved on sort of global television.
Your ratings just went up.
Because you could imagine that other people may not be. They would be freaking out. Yeah. And I think the great thing is that you know these other two game shows really well. People may not know not what to wear as much because it's, you know, they're helping people with style and yeah, you kind of think, well, where's this going to go? And then, of course, it's all about chopping off the head and stitching on whatever we've got, you know, to make you look even more fabulous.
I think they're super menacing. They're fabulously, fabulously menacing. And I think it's just before a cut to a scene where, you know, one of them pulls off their hands and reveals the big chainsaw and stuff. I just think all of that is so tremendously funny because it's the odd man out. It's not really a competitive reality show, is it? It's a sort of more of a makeover show, and they tend to be action. Look, they're all about consumption and they're superficial, but it's not quite the cutthroat thing that the Weakest Link is, for example.
Well, it's, I mean, we now call that lifestyle, don't we?
Yeah.
Like, it's not specifically about the reality, it's about the style. I mean, it's actually, in a way, it's not negative.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of those shows where someone comes in and sort of helps someone improve their lives. And, you know, Gordon Ramsay, who is a person about whom it's possible to have opinions, you know, it swears at people and sort of screams and is generally obnoxious and then goes into a restaurant and changes it to look identical to the restaurant from the previous program, you know. But there is something sort of fun about an expert coming in to sort of help out.
I like the fact that they turn this lifestyle show on its head with the Face Off the end, which is just a brilliant name. Yeah. But, of course, Jack then has the great comedy moment of reveal. Where were you hiding that? With the Compact Laser Deluxe, which, of course, you don't want to think too much about.
All anybody thought about when they watched.
Well, it's one of those silly moments from Russell, which is
I was looking at how small it was. It's not that small.
No, absolutely not.
It wasn't quite a pine cone off the Christmas tree, but it wasn't that wee.
I'm sure he prepped first.
One of the delicious things about these game shows is they're all running parallel, which everything's getting revealed at once. And what's going on is dawning on both Rose and the Doctor at the same time, that things aren't as they are. And we're all heading to try and escape. And the Doctor does escape with Linda to try and find the others. And we then get some really nice moments between him and Linda discussing what's gone on Satellite 5 when it dawns on him that's where he is. And he thinks he's put everything to right. But, of course, he hasn't. And it's coming back to that thing about consequences and the contrast with the original series where the Doctor would just leave and that's it. But here, leaving 5 episodes ago, actually has had big ramifications just...
It's destroyed the world.
And he says, I created this world. This is the world that I created.
He was Zoannan all the time.
He was. But, I mean, this is the world we live in now. Half of us are too fat, half of us are too thin, and we're all kind of anaesthetized by watching television. This is just what's happening now. In Series 3, we'll see the Daleks being used very explicitly as a metaphor for capitalism. But I think that here they are as well.
And they're going to get even more interesting because we haven't actually seen them this episode yet, have we?
No.
No, at this point, you don't quite know who's in control, but then Linda turns on the lights in the level that they're on and we get to see Bad Wolf. And again, we get another flashback sequence to all the...
All the uses of Bad Wolf.
Of Bad Wolf. And so Russell is very good at directing your thoughts in one direction about this corporation. You don't know that it's... I'm not going to talk about next week's episode, but you ultimately, by the end of this episode, you believe that it is the Daleks that are
or
the Janet bad wolf.
Fielding. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Richard.
But the Bad Wolf Corporation has been running Satellite 5 for years, and we learn later that the Daleks have been as well. Just check out our episode on The Long Game, because Bad Wolf is clearly Fox. And yes. The Long Game is about the effect of the Fox network.
And that did not occur to me until I listened to that episode.
Yeah.
Or watched Murphy like, Brown.
I kind of, oh gosh, how stupid am I?
Yeah. No. I mean, we know that Bad Wolf is a thing, but it actually occurs natively here. All of the other times we'll discover that Billy's scattered it through time and space, but this is the place where the words Bad Wolf originate from. So the Bad Wolf Corporation are the people who run the games. Or are they?
The point of this is, again, it's working because it's not what we're just seeing on screen. It's what we're taking from a lot of other shows.
Yeah.
Russell's a really clever man, and so is Julie, and so is Phil Collinson, and they're looking at what are antecedents to this. He loves fairy stories. All these references you're talking about with Red Riding Hood or Rose Riding Hood leaving, scattering breadcrumbs in her trail, again, is a grim fairy story.
Yeah.
Now, Russell is mates with Marina Warner, who's one of the best writers. She's actually the modern take on Joseph Campbell, and we've referenced Joseph Campbell before because, of course, he wrote the first Star Wars script for George Lucas. He did. Yeah. But he was the first professor of mythology, international mythology. I mean, that's just every guy you meet who sells comics now. But back then, it was a very rare thing. Marina Warner has a chair at Cambridge where she does the same thing, and she writes constantly and wonderfully, and has done since I left high school. Monuments and Maidens is her first book, The Allegory of the Female Form, and she talks about Mae West, the Statue of Liberty, and there's another American icon she does. She's fabulous and funny and camp and clever. But she also completely dissected the Grimm fairy stories. And a lot of these references that Russell's throwing in here are very much Marina Warner's archetypes and writing about how modern culture is so imbued with exactly the same stories. Culture doesn't change, is what Campbell and Marina Warner are saying, that we just go round and round in circles, repeating, not necessarily in a bad way, but repeating our errors and our foibles and our little ways. Sometimes we part our little ways, but we're not up there yet. But yeah, the point is that these lovely circles of narrative and gormlessness, if you like, that the follies that we trip over ourselves, but sometimes they can be the same things that save us. The silliness and the childishness can be the things that rescue us. So I won't crap on about it too much, but I think I've already presaged my pick of the week there.
I think, too, that when Gwyneth first mentions Bad Wolf... Yeah, that's right. When Gwyneth from The Unquiet Dead first mentions Bad Wolf, she says the big bad wolf in the darkness, and it sounds like just a reference to a Grimm's fairy tale.
It does. That makes that egg out of Boomtown very rude.
Did you know the woman who plays the female programmer was a Red Kang?
Really?
No. Yes. I knew you were going to do Jamesy's hottie list. Which one was she?
She was one of the non-speaking.
I want you to tell me she was married to Turlough.
No.
Too good.
Not James. Yeah. I've just taken off a point of this episode.
So Nish Nayar, the love interest.
Isn't that lovely?
Female programmer. She was one of the Kangs.
Oh, that's lovely.
Also, the controller, her father was in Doctor Who.
Gosh.
What?
Was
he the Fury from
Martha
the Deep?
Cope.
Is that where she got all
the daughter
her
of Kenneth
points?
Cope.
Kenneth
who,
Cope?
He was Packard in Warrior's Gate. And
he's actually a proper
and
actor.
In Randall and Hopkirk Deceased.
I didn't realise he was... No, he's an actual proper actor.
Yes. No, she's his daughter.
Oh, that's lovely.
You know, I'm a Doctor Who fan. I'm like, what have I seen this person in?
Drives my husband mad.
You know, I have to say this, and I think listeners may be wanting a rant off me, but I find it really hard to rant about a lot of episodes because they're generally of a good standard and there's only little things that sort of annoy me. But I'm going to move on from all of that. I'm going to say we're almost up to the point where the Doctor and the team are going to rescue Rose, but there is a conversation that the Doctor does have with Linda where she asks who he is and then she actually says, I could come with you. And I remember watching that at the time thinking, oh, that's not good. Like the moment, I just feel that moment people say, I could come with you and voice themselves on the Doctor, I always get red flags as to, well, that could not possibly end well. So I might be misremembering, but it's just something that came into my mind when I watched it. I kind of thought, oh, you might be doomed.
I also think, too, that we didn't know what sort of show this was or what its rules were even now. And it's just possible that she comes along because something is going to happen to Rose next episode, that we may be introducing Jo Joyner's character in order for her to replace Billy Piper.
It's very much what it feels like.
Yeah.
And, but who knows that that wasn't planted in the scripts early on just to be...
Well, yeah. We'll talk about that. I think we'll talk about that next week.
Yeah.
And her character's name is Linda Moss. Reminds me of something else. Press Gang. Who's the woman in Press Gang?
So she's Linda Day.
Oh, sorry.
And she is Linda with a Y. And I also think that Linda with a Y is a great way of getting you to remember her name. We even get a little bit of deft exposition about Linda with an eye damaging one of the cameras when she's introducing herself, and that bit of exposition becomes, you know, crucial to the Doctor's escape. So I think it's just a little bit of clever writing, but it's such a charming performance. She's so vulnerable, and she's dead sweet, just like the Doctor says. Mm. That's a beautiful little scene where she's terrified that she might be evicted because no one even knows who she is, and the Doctor says that she's dead sweet.
That's foreshadowing. Yeah,
I know, but it also sort of struck me as a kind of slang that the Doctor would never have used before either, which is beautiful. Like, it's such a nice scene. He lies to make her feel better.
So then they go in to rescue Rose at the crescendo of The Weakest Link.
Yeah.
And I just want to say here, shout out, one of the answers is Hazel Dean.
Yes.
And I almost fell over because I... Again, this was new to me, listeners, watching this episode.
I think he actually says San Hazel Dean.
Like it's a space name.
It was a line about like a fault line or an earthquake or something.
I can't remember exactly.
Like, where did this happen? San Hazel Dean?
Yeah. If you don't know, Hazel Dean is a 1980s pop star in the UK who had about three big hits.
It does turn out, too, that Jackie Collins is still a well-known author in 200,000 times.
So anyway, Rose loses. And then she gets blasted into dust.
Just as the Doctor's rescuing her and she's running towards him and off she goes.
That's another reference to the Twin Dilemma.
Zanium.
What?
The dust on the ground is
traces
the
result
of a transmat being.
Yes. They don't say that in this episode, do they?
No, but someone picks it up and it's silvery dust on the floor.
I would never have believed in a million years I'd be sitting here thinking that this episode links to the Twin Dilemma.
But all three of the rest of us thought of it.
Yeah,
we did.
As we were instantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instantly. Yeah.
Thanks for that, Nathan.
Well, we know who the real Colin Baker fans are.
We know who the weakest link is, don't we, people? Goodbye. What a moment. Like, and the music at that point, just the way, and his reaction. I remember thinking at the time, this can't be happening. This can't be real. They have to get out of it. But
how? How could they possibly do it?
Exactly. Yeah.
I also think, too, that that moves into some of the most smartly directed Doctor Who that we've had this episode, because it's all been sort of cardboard sets because we've been doing sort of cheap game show knockoffs. But suddenly the camera becomes all sort of German impressionism, where we're seeing it from the Doctor's point of view. There's action going on in the background, but it's out of focus and the sound is muted. We bring up the music. We're just on the Doctor's face, and all we're invited to think about is how devastated the Doctor is by this. And we see, you know, they go into that sort of grungy industrialist kind of cell, and it just looks like the Doctor's been completely broken.
The next sequences are really interesting, like in the interrogation cell or the prison cell that they're put into, and just sitting there and these guys are shouting at them. Spoiler alert to no one. I had no memory of this. Like, when I watched it, I literally sat there going, I remember them getting out of the cell, but none of this shouting at the Doctor and telling them that they're going to go to the lunar colonies or whatever it is. It's really quite disturbing.
is shot very differently from the way Doctor Who normally is too, because it's like a lot of short scenes all happening in the same place, where each shot is a sort of different time period. They're clearly in there for a long time being sort of interrogated, and you get absolutely no response from the Doctor at any point. He's done.
But then on a dime, it's sort of like, let's do this thing.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah, and they escape. But I think that, you know, that scene is beautifully lit. Mm. The sets look incredible. Mm. It's really something. And the Doctor and Jack are quite violent in kind of overcoming the guards. They're sort of kicks and stuff like that. It's a pretty good scene.
It is. And they make their way up to control, which we've seen a few times already.
We haven't really talked about the male and female programmer, have we?
So is it Davish Papel?
Well, they're actually just credited as male and female programmers. Oh. And the male one's only given a name so that he can properly flirt with Captain Jack next episode.
I think they're good performances from both of them. Get the feeling that she's the controller, but she's not in control. There's somebody behind her.
Very much so, yes.
And is it the Banks? Who is it?
Yeah.
As classic series Doctor Who fans, did we think it was the Daleks?
I don't know that we did particularly know. I mean, it's almost impossible to remember from this sort of distance, I think.
I think it's impossible to tell what you would have thought if it hadn't been spoiled for you. I mean, I cannot separate the fact that I knew the Daleks were coming back this week because of the Next Time trailer at the end of the previous episode. So you know, outside of the story itself, you know the Daleks are behind it somehow, or they're behind something in the episode. If you didn't have any of those Next Time trailers at all, if there was no sort of lead-in between episodes, it would be a much bigger surprise.
Originally, the Next Time trailers were just there because the episodes were underrunning, I think. But Russell's previous shows had Next Time trailers. So Queer as Folk, for instance, and The Second Coming both have Next Time trailers. And I actually think that it manages to create a little cliffhanger in a way that, you know, we don't normally have because we don't have that many two-part stories. So it is a way of getting us to come back next week, which is what the cliffhanger is. And I also think, too, that anything kind of that's revealed outside the show, and we're sort of acutely aware of this very, very spoiler-free kind of atmosphere that we've got now with Series 11, everything that is released, I think, is deliberately released. And so I think the effect of knowing that the Daleks are back this week is that as we're watching it, we sit down waiting for the Daleks to come. And, you know, 30 minutes in, 35 minutes in, there's no sign of them. And maybe we've forgotten about it by then because it's all been sort of fairly engaging. But that does make me suspect that I probably was thinking that the controller who had been there since she was five might have been being controlled by the Daleks. But I guess I couldn't be sure. I think it's a sort of fairly standard scene, sort of action scene, where suddenly the Doctor again is a man with a gun running up to avenge the death of his woman. He's so broken that he turns into a sort of standard action hero, and then very quickly that's diffused with that fantastic scene.
Where I like the way that Russell always writes that is the ultimate defeat for the Doctor.
Yeah.
And to become an American.
And the last time he did that was
Dalek.
In Dalek.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's another parallel.
But he immediately throws his gun to the male programmer, which I just think is a fabulously Doctorish thing to do. It's like Paul McGann holding a gun to his head, only not really, really terrible.
Whereas I don't think Jack gives up his guns.
No, he's not an out-of-bounds kind of guy.
But he does get into the TARDIS and into the plot point of working out that the Death Ray is, in fact, not the Death Ray, so that we can have a joyous scene between the Doctor and Jack.
But don't you think he should have just rushed in and said, actually, I've just discovered that the death rays don't kill people, they just transport you. Instead, he just tells Linda, you stand over here while I shoot you. It's a fantastic scene. It's like super amazing and she's really good in it. But
show, don't tell.
Yes. Yes. So she's
here's one I made earlier.
Oh yes, I'm going to show you. And then, and when she comes back, she's sort of like all sort of wobbly and stunned. You can't help but laugh. And of course, at that point, then we do cut to the Daleks' spaceship and that that wonderful music.
That is
part of their...
Well, that is Philip Glass. And then it's actually Bernard Herrmann, and then it's Philip Glass. Murray Gold, like this podcast, like Doctor Who, is always good when he's doing something else, somebody else.
It's great music.
It's Akhenaten. Lifted directly from Philip
Glass.
It's Hebrew,
isn't it? It's chanting what is
happening. Oh, the chanting stuff. No, I was talking about the actual moments of introduction. Yeah. No, the chanting is what?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd heard Hebrew as well, I think. The saucer design is from where? You know the saucer?
It's very close to the comics from the 60s, the Century 21 Dalek back panel strip.
Because
we're back to the tiny gun again, aren't we? Yes.
Do you remember the Dalek Invasion of Earth DVD release where there's a special option where you can replace the wobbly tinfoil plate with a sort of rather stately...
version of these.
Looks like them. And that predates that. So it is the classic sort of flying saucer things. And I think that Russell has said in interviews that Terry Nation had always really wanted to create a giant space opera with thousands of Daleks and spaceships and stuff, and now we can finally do it. So this is what Dalek Master Plan might have looked like.
And the artists, was it Eric Eden who drew the Century 21 strip for part of it? Anyway, they all started working on Frank Hampson's Dan Dare strips of the early 1950s, and just a little squee moment, the Dalek missiles are directly lifted from Treen missiles from Dan Dare. I know. These things are so important to people like us.
I really love the whole reveal of all of those ships. I love the fact that, you know, we've got dialogue about someone's been playing a long game.
Yeah. Boom,
and then we obviously get the thousands of ships and thousands, half a million Daleks or whatever have been created. And the Daleks, of course, monitor it and go, we have been detected, and announce to the Doctor that we have your... associate.
Yes, they don't have friends, Daleks. No.
Is this a sexual associate?
No companions, no assistants, just your associate.
So this is a different kind of cliffhanger. This is a Rose in Peril cliffhanger, and the final shot is her being surrounded by lots of kind of Daleks, floating Daleks and stuff like that. But it's not quite that, is it? Because of the Doctor's speech. What do we think of this as a cliffhanger?
No.
What is the meaning of this negative, Todd?
I don't know. I'm as confused as the Daleks. But it's very effective.
Traditionally, that sort of cliffhanger would have been exterminate, 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 and a close-up on the companion. It's completely subverting what you expect. She's not dead, and she's not in immediate peril. She's not about to be exterminated. It's the Doctor... being powerful and triumphant and spurred on by his desire to get his friend out of danger.
Yeah.
The only thing he's not doing is the Austrian accent. They've already lampshaded President Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
And you think, if only they'd actually just watched that episode of The Simpsons and said President Trump, we would have, oh God. But yeah, because it's a Schwarzenegger moment, which in itself is a John Ford, John Huston Western moment where everything is gone, you know, the farms are burnt, the cattle is lost. So what do? We just say, no, you haven't won. I'm going to come in lone and without a gun, and I'm going to bitch slap and tongue lash the buggery out of all of you, and you're going to whimper.
Yeah.
Whimper. And yes.
Yeah, it's...
Yes, with all my northern brittle edginess. He's quite camp. He's
I think the closest parallel is the "there's one thing you don't put into a trap" speech in Time of Angels in Series 5. We know that the Doctor is going to rescue her. There's absolutely no doubt after that speech that Rose isn't in peril. She'll be fine. And so the big thing that we're looking forward to is the Doctor actually doing that. What's he going to do next week?
The Next Time trailer, when I was watching this, comes literally straight away. Like, it's not at the end of the credits.
Yeah.
It's boom, straight up. And I guess I'm used to them being at the end credits based on 10 series, but in this series, they're not always there.
Yeah.
There's sort of like a second cliffhanger.
Yeah.
By having that, because there's that big booming voice, "It survived through me." You think, what the blazes is that? That's another, besides that, I'm left with, what is this big voice? "It survived
through me, Peter,"
said Janet.
I think it's a great second cliffhanger. I love it. Like I said, I spent all week speculating about who the hell that was. I had no idea. And I think by then I hadn't heard the Emperor Dalek from Evil of the Daleks, whose voice that is.
It's pretty close to it, isn't it? Yeah. It's also a Century 21 comic again.
Yeah.
And Janet's Mara. I mean, she's never been far away.
Fangirling.
Yes.
Have you been listening to a lot of Janet or something?
I actually do. It's funny. Again, my pick of the week. I've been listening to all of the Big Finish Janet Fielding, you know, say, "I will never come back to Big Finish." But she has, and she's the best. They are my favourite Big Finishers. Yeah.
But that's your pick for next week.
Possibly.
Well, that's our cliffhanger, I guess. You can all come back next week and find out what Richard's pick of the week is.
Yes, his nose, probably. Have a biscuit.
Listener, it looks like we're going to be spending the week trapped on that giant Dalek spaceship, but at least we're all wearing our stylish and affordable pairs of Stella Pockbaint shoes. We'll be back next week for the denouement in the parting of the ways.
It was hats.
In the meantime, you can find us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also find us at Jodie Into Terror, where we phone each other up in our pajamas to debrief about each episode of Series 11. That's jodieintoterror.com, Jodie Into Terror on Apple Podcasts, and at Jodie Into Terror on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, we've now flown through the entire James Bond film franchise, providing expert commentary on every film. You can find it all at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Until next time, may your viewing figures always continue to go up. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
See you soon.
Ta-ta. I should like a hat like that.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley, James Selwood and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Your Whole Existence is Watching Television, was recorded on the 14th of October 2018 and released on the 11th of November. Here at FDE Productions, we'd like to apologise for the length of this episode's outro, which was necessitated by the recent expansion of the FDE cinematic universe. Our next new podcast, The Death of Cyril Shapps, will be released sometime in late 2019. And I think there's a sort of large-hipped woman who goes around hotels with an ultraviolet light and checks all the bedclothes and stuff and then berates people. Like, that's a sort of genre of TV. I guess what not to wear is a problem because of the consumerism aspect.
On an aside about blue lights, when I worked at the ABC many years ago, there was a book that was out called Spotless.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Like handy hips to clean your house. And the woman, she was a housewife who had all these handy tips and she became a household name because she appeared on the ABC. But she used to tell people to come into the shops and buy the sonic screwdrivers so that it could use them to look for stains on on things around the house.
Where are you going with this? Oh, no.
So the light from the sonic screwdriver would actually show
pick
up
stains. Oh. On,
like what, a must for anyone who has teenage boys.
Yeah, a cheap person's ultraviolet light kind of thing.
Could they find compact laser deluxe?
Well, you know, people complain that they don't learn anything for this podcast, but there you go. That's a little helpful tip that you can take into your own personal
life. So you could
line.
Actually use the Ninth Doctor's sonic to... I thought it was just a 101 uses.
It's got three settings.